I hope you've enjoyed your lunch. We're going to try and keep on track. My name is Julius Sis. I'm the executive director of Jews for Judaism, our co-sponsor for the program. And I'm very happy for you to be here this afternoon for our part of our fourth annual Judaism and Christianity conference. I just want to take a moment to introduce Rabbi Skobach. Rabbi Skobach is an integral part of Jews for Judaism and is very much involved in our preventive education programming, dealing a lot also with the counseling of Jews who are involved in all aspects of Christianity. But not only that, he works in counseling Jewish people who are involved in Eastern religions and Hinduism and Buddhism, cults, destructive cults, and dealing with issues of intermarriage. He's had a great deal of experience in trying to help the Jewish people. His experience, though, specifically in Christianity, exceeds 30 years in dealing with monitoring the missionary problem and understanding why we are the targets of so many evangelical fundamentalist Christians. His experience goes beyond that, but I'm going to allow Rabbi Skobach to expound on what it is he has to share in terms of evangelicals and Israel, knight in shining armor or a Trojan horse.
I was a young student at Fairlawn High School in the late 60s, and I don't remember much from back then, but I had a social studies teacher named Mr. Verdicchio, who was very fond of quoting, I guess it's a famous saying, that both in politics and in religion, people have a tendency to speak with a degree of conviction that's inversely proportional to the amount of knowledge they have. And I always thought that was funny, too. And I think that I'm saying that because if you sense any kind of equivocation on my part this afternoon, don't chalk it up to an attempt on my part to appear modest. But rather, I think it's a concession to the enormous complexity of the issue at hand. I think it's important to state frequently this afternoon that this topic does not lend itself to simplistic and definitive black and white pronouncements. And therefore, we'll be painting this afternoon in shades of nuanced gray. A few years ago, I was invited to speak at a Jews for Jesus congregation a few blocks from here. I still don't understand why they invited me. And I wasn't given an open mic. I was asked to address a specific topic, which is how the Jews for Jesus movement is perceived in the Jewish community. And I began my remarks that afternoon by sharing a halacha. The Shulchan Aruch tells us that if a person loses a close relative that has a bit of money, you actually say two blessings. You say Baruch Dayan Emet on the Patira, on the death of the relative, but you say Baruch HaTova HaMeitiv on the inheritance that you're going to receive. So there are many things in life where our reaction can very easily be mixed. We can feel at the same time tremendous joy and at the same time tremendous lack of joy, or even worse. And I think that's the tone with which I want to approach the topic for this afternoon. What is very clear, I think, for all of us, is that Israel and the Jewish people today are living in a world that is growing increasingly dangerous and threatening. And into this mix of hostility, of indifference, of criticism, of threats, of actual violence, there has been one group that has emerged as an enthusiastic and committed ally and supporter of our people, and that's the evangelical Christian right. So who are these evangelicals? It's pretty clear that the 2 billion Christians in the world are not a monolithic group. There were about 900 million Roman Catholics. They're obviously not part of our discussion this afternoon. And then we have all sorts of small, assorted, different quasi-Christian groups, from Mormons to Seventh-day Adventists, the various Orthodox Christian groups. But aside from the Roman Catholic Church, the major other group in Christendom are the Protestants. But here it gets a bit dicey, because as opposed to the Roman Catholic Church, which is united under a pope, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of Protestant denominations. There was a recent article in the Jewish Action magazine where Rabbi Yitzhak Adlerstein painted, I thought, was a very helpful picture of the mainline liberal Protestant denominations and their animosity towards our interests in the land of Israel. But we know that during the last part of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, the fundamentalist movement, as it were, grew up really as a reaction to the liberalizing tendencies within Protestantism that really began in the days of the Enlightenment. And during the last half of the 20th century, starting about the 1950s, we saw the very, very dramatic rise of the evangelical movement, which really grew out of the fundamentalists. The major difference would be probably the fact that the evangelicals, as opposed to fundamentalist Christians, we'd call them much more modern. They are fully committed to engaging the modern world and much less reclusive than the fundamentalists. There are at least three things that all evangelical Christians stress. One is the authority of Scripture. As one famous bumper sticker says, "The Bible says it, I believe it, and that settles it." Also, among evangelicals, the need to be born again, which means you cannot be born a Christian. The idea is that every person has to go through a personal conversion experience where they become saved from sin and develop a personal relationship with Jesus, who they see as the incarnation of God. And finally, the third plank would be a focus on evangelism, hence the name evangelical, which is the idea of reaching out to those people who are seen as lost. It's a world that is cut very neatly between those who are saved and those who are lost. In Canada, approximately 10% of our nation here identify as evangelical Protestants. But down south of the border, the number is repeatedly found to be in polls at least 25%. Some people even go higher, of Americans identify as evangelical Protestants. Now, this is a very sizable group, obviously, in any country, and they became the power base of the conservative Republican Party that was able to have someone like Pat Robertson, a televangelist, actually make a serious run for the U.S. presidency in the late 1980s, and also a group that managed to elect George Bush twice to the U.S. presidency. Another effect of having such a large group of evangelicals in the U.S. is that it made personal religious faith a prerequisite for holding any kind of high office in the U.S. I don't know in Canada if the media or the pundits really ask candidates too much about their personal religious faith. But in the U.S., an atheist or an agnostic doesn't have a chance in hell of running for president. It's not going to happen. Now, part of the complexity of our issue this afternoon is that the evangelical world itself is far from monolithic. And they're a very complex organism that don't all march together in one lockstep. For example, the Pew Forum on Religious and Public Life polled two very important groups among evangelicals. One we can call more modern evangelicals, and one we'll call the more Haredi evangelicals, more right-wing evangelicals. So among these two groups, some very interesting numbers in terms of support for Israel. Among what we call the more modern evangelicals, 52% did advocate very strong support for Israel over Palestinians. However, 25% disagreed, and 23% had no opinion whatsoever. Well, that's not a very, very strong majority. Among more traditional evangelicals, 61% agreed that there should be strong public support for Israel over Palestinians. However, 18% disagreed, almost a fifth. And 18% had no opinion whatsoever. Notwithstanding these figures, it's fairly clear that, as Jerry Falwell has expressed, America's Bible Belt is Israel's safety belt. And we know that over the past number of decades, the Christian right has been responsible for tremendous political support in North America, especially in the United States, for Israel, lobbying the government, activism on behalf of the land of Israel, tremendous numbers of ongoing rallies and prayer meetings to support Israel. Some of you don't know this, but in Ontario, there are many churches that had 40-day fasts in support of Israel. I don't know of any synagogues where the members fasted for 40 days in support of Israel. So there are a number of churches right here in Ontario, Ad Kedei Kach, that was how strong they wanted to identify with our interest in the land of Israel. Tremendous financial support to Israel, to Israeli institutions, support of Aliyah. And finally, tourism. We know that during both intifadas, Jewish tourism plummeted when the intifadas began, and Christian tourism actually increased. So these are people who don't just talk the talk, they walk the walk, and they actually are engaged in tremendous advocacy on our behalf in the land of Israel. Before his illness, Prime Minister Sharon told a group of Christian pilgrims that you are our best friend in the world. Why is it that evangelicals support Israel? I think there are many, many reasons. I'm going to share 10 of them with you. The foundation is very clearly the idea that our Bible and their Bible gives the Jewish people the legal and the moral rights to the land of Israel. That is the rock-solid foundation upon which evangelical support for Israel is based. There's also, as Rabbi Korn mentioned this morning, an identification with Israel as Middle East's only democracy and the strategic interest of having this state in the Middle East as a very helpful ally in the international war on terror. Christians today find in the Bible, in the book of Isaiah, the biblical mandate to comfort the Jewish people, comfort Israel. They find in the book of Psalms to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Of course, as Rabbi Korn mentioned as well, they identify very strongly with the promise in Genesis that God will bless those who bless the Jewish people and curse those who curse the Jewish people. As well, evangelicals have a tremendous sense of gratitude to the Jewish people for many of the things they see as their greatest blessings. They thank us for their Bible. They thank us for their Messiah. They thank us for the prophets that inform them. As well, evangelicals express a tremendous sense of remorse and repentance over their past, over historic anti-Semitism, over the failure of the Christian world during the Shoah to support the Jewish people in any significant way. Also, evangelicals clearly identify with the idea that the Jewish people are God's chosen people. As the Bible says, the apple of God's eye. We shouldn't underestimate the fact that for many, many Christians, the land of Israel has a very, very sentimental place in their heart. Pilgrims flock every year to places in Israel that they learned about in Sunday school. And therefore, for many Christians, there's a sense that for them, the land of Israel belongs to them almost as much as it belongs to us. And finally, for some Christians, the ideas of eschatology and end-time prophecy become important. 1948 and 1967 were very critical years for Christians. They were exhilarating years because the events of 1948 and 1967 confirmed for many Christians the fact that the Bible prophecy is being fulfilled in our time, and therefore they feel that the promise of the second coming of Jesus, which for Christians was already put off for thousands of years, they now see it as an imminent possibility. They see Jerusalem as ground zero for what they believe will be the end time scenarios of Armageddon, the rapture, the second coming of Jesus, everything that they teach about and preach about in terms of the end times, they see as really connected to our homeland. It's fairly clear that we as a people have to be grateful and appreciative for Christian support for Israel. The Israeli government for the past 25 years has been very aggressively courting the evangelical Christian right because they see that this is an important and critical ally for their existence today in the world. And yet, many Jewish people, especially in North America, have a certain ambivalence towards the Christian right. Especially for mainstream American and North American Jews, there's a huge divergence with evangelicals when it comes to the broader political and domestic issues that we all face. If you read the recent stirrings from the Anti-Defamation League and the reform movement in the U.S., there was tremendous concern that the Christian right is seeking to Christianize North America and to tear down the traditional walls of separation between church and state. This is an area of discomfort for many, many Jewish people. We know that the mainstream North American Jewish community is often associated with very liberal positions when it comes to almost all social issues. And therefore, liberal North American Jewry tends to be very, very uncomfortable with the evangelical world and their lack of tolerance, their opposition to pluralism, their opposition to things like gun control, abortion, welfare, gay rights, and their advocacy of things like school prayer. When Jerry Falwell blamed the attacks at the World Trade Center on 9/11 on the pagans, abortionists, feminists, gays, and lesbians, many people suspected that what he also meant was the ACLU, liberal Jews, Hollywood, and secular humanism. There are also many speed bumps on the relationship between the evangelical community and the Jewish community from their side. Many, many evangelicals grew very impatient with the loud vitriolic attacks by many Jewish leaders on Mel Gibson's Passion film a number of years ago. They saw these attacks as attacks on their Bible and on their religion. We know that the evangelical leader who was recently disgraced, Ted Haggard, raised the potential for withdrawing support for Israel. During the heat of those days, Ted Haggard said, "There's a great deal of pressure on Israel right now, and Christians seem to be a major source of support for Israel. For Jewish leaders to risk alienating 2 billion Christians over a movie seems short-sighted." When they want to increase their numbers, everybody gets invited back onto the team. Don Wildman, who's the president of the Evangelical American Family Association, who was responding to recent attacks by Abe Foxman and the ADL, said, "The more that Foxman says that you people are destroying this country, the more some people are going to get fed up with this and say, well, if that's the way you feel, then we just won't support Israel anymore." So we shouldn't assume that evangelical support for Israel is necessarily 100% across the board or even 100% given. Let's return to Jewish issues with the evangelical right. Some Jewish people have been suspicious of lingering and latent anti-Semitism in Christian America. When Bailey Smith proclaimed at two different national meetings of the Southern Baptist Convention that God does not hear the prayers of a Jew, he was wildly cheered. There's frequent talk among evangelicals about Jews being spiritually blind. leaders like Pat Robertson in their books draw very heavily upon old conspiracy theories like the learned protocols of the elders of Zion. And of course, we all experienced a certain lack of empathy. I don't know if anyone really thought that the Gibson film was going to be pulled, but certainly a lack of empathy from the Christian right in terms of how the Jewish feelings may have been stepped on. The old Hasidic story tells about two Russians drinking in a bar. And one friend says to his other friend, Ivan, do you love me? And Ivan says, of course I love you. And his friend says, if you love me, tell me what hurts me. And Ivan says, I don't know what hurts you. He says, if you don't know what hurts me, you can't really love me. So for Christians to have been so blind to the pain that this film would have caused the Jewish community seems to really question the amount of love they have for us. Some Jewish people have been concerned about the extreme political positions of the Christian right, often far to the right of even the most right-wing groups in Israel itself. For example, many evangelicals are totally opposed to giving back any land whatsoever, even in the context of a peace initiative. We know that in Israel, Pat Robertson caused a tremendous stir recently when he blamed the disengagement plan in Gaza for Prime Minister Sharon's stroke. We know that some evangelicals oppose any kind of Palestinian state, even though a majority of Israelis seem to feel that a two-state solution is inevitable. And some evangelicals simply want to annex the entire West Bank and transfer all Palestinians. As one evangelical put it recently, we don't care how the Israelis vote. We care what God says. And he gave the land to the Jews. Some evangelicals have supported projects to rebuild now the Third Temple on the Temple Mount, the possible destruction of the mosques there, regardless of how provocative these kind of actions would be seen. Some people have concern with evangelical Christian beliefs about end-time prophecies. Israeli author Gershon Gorenberg has written that these Christians love us as characters in their story, in their play, and we never auditioned for the part. And the play doesn't end up as good for us because they support us in order to see us finished off. They see world history as a five-part play where the Jews disappear in the fourth act. Now, it's true that some end-time Christian speculation does actually envision either the mass conversion of the Jewish people or their mass destruction. But we should realize that not all evangelicals accept this kind of dispensational premillennialism that was popularized by Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth, and the incredibly popular Left Behind series today. And aside from the fact that not all Christians accept this theology, Jewish leaders like Mort Klein from the ZOA have said, I want their support now, and I don't really care what their theology says about what might happen down the line. And one last issue of concern is the question of evangelism. The basic reality, which I still find perplexing, that so many Jewish people seem to have difficulty reconciling with their support for Israel, but the basic reality is that the very same people who are the strongest allies for our political interests in the land of Israel are the very people that are behind the massive attempts to convert Jewish people across the world. Jerry Falwell said recently, Jews are returning to their land of unbelief. They are spiritually blind and desperately in need of their Messiah and Savior. Yet they are God's people. And in the world today, Bible-believing Christians in America are the best friends that the nation of Israel has. So it is sentiments like this that really highlight the truly complex and ambiguous relationship that we have with this group. While it's true that many of these evangelical Christians love Israel and support Israel, They do not love Judaism. And they grant Judaism absolutely no legitimacy whatsoever. I think it's important for all of us to understand the absolute centrality that evangelism plays for these people. The core verse in the Christian Bible, John 3:16, says that God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, so that all who would believe in him would not perish, but have eternal life. For Christians, that's the bottom line. That if you accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior, you will spend your eternity in heaven. But anyone who does not become a born-again Christian is seen as perishing, as lost, as destined to spend an eternity burning in hell. And therefore, Christians with this perspective look at the world in very pragmatic ways. And they try to look at everyone they know. And they want to know, what can I do to get my friends, my neighbors, my relatives, my coworkers? I want to make sure that if they die tomorrow, they're not going to be going to hell. These are people who feel that they have something much more valuable than the cure for cancer. They have the cure for eternal damnation. And therefore, they have a moral, ethical obligation to share this knowledge with every person on the planet. And of course, the Christian mission is not just to Jews. The Christian mission is to all non-Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, Baha'is, Sikhs, Jains, Native Canadians, Native Americans, atheists, Catholics, who they often see as also in great spiritual danger, and liberal Protestants, anyone who is not born again. Jimmy Swaggart once held up a picture of Mother Teresa and said, this is a woman that's going to be burning in hell forever because she was not a born-again Protestant. But notwithstanding this Christian obsession with converting the entire world, we are very clearly a special target. There are over 1,000 different Christian mission organizations in North America that target the Jewish community. That's way out of proportion to our numbers compared to other religious and ethnic groups. Part of the reason is that the Christian Bible, which includes our Hebrew scriptures, points Christians in our direction. They open up their Bible, they read about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Moses, and Aaron, and Isaiah, and Jewish people. They read a lot of Jewish people. They read a book that speaks about the Jews being God's chosen people. They don't find any Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus in their Bible. And they get to their Greek Testament, where Jesus is a Jew. His 12 followers are Jews. They're living in the land of Israel. Jesus says to his followers, don't go to the cities of the Samaritans or the Gentiles. I'm only here, he says, for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So that the priority, even in the Christian scriptures, upon reaching the Jewish people. Paul in the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 16, says that the good news is to go to the Jews first and then to the Greek. For many Christians, there's a feeling that the second coming will not take place until the Jewish people embrace Jesus. In the book of Matthew, chapter 23, verse 39, Jesus says, you will never see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And he was speaking to a Jewish audience. And therefore, many Christians believe that what this verse is teaching them is that Jesus will not return until the Jewish people in large numbers come to faith in Christianity. And therefore, part of the specific targeting of the Jewish community is tied into this idea that we as a group are holding up the second coming. We are the group that's getting in the way of progress. And lastly, there's a tremendous psychological obsession with reaching the Jewish people. Because every Jewish person, on some level, annoys a serious thinking Christian. Because we really shouldn't exist here anymore. I've had Christians tell me they'd rather convert one Jew than 1,000 Gentiles. Why is that? One Christian leader, James Christensen, who was the General Secretary of the American Baptist Church's National Mission Society, said, after all, unconverted Jews make Christians wonder if perhaps Jesus was not the Messiah after all. Christians are well aware of the fact that 2,000 years ago, the only people on the planet with a shred of ability to determine who was the Messiah would have been the Jewish people. The rest of the world were pagan barbarians. They didn't have much of a meaningful vote. And those experts who knew better 2,000 years ago didn't accept Jesus. The only people who ultimately became churched were the people who, prior to their exposure to Christianity, knew nothing about one God or the Bible or the concept of Messiah. And therefore, there's a tremendous psychological need for Christians to reach Jewish people. It's fairly clear that our community has no problem deciding how to interact with groups like Jews for Jesus or Chosen People Ministries or the Christian Jew Foundation, regardless of how much they love and support Israel. We all seem to be united, no matter where we stand in the Jewish world, that these are groups we cannot work with, we cannot congratulate, we cannot feel great about their support. However, the problem is that the vast majority of evangelical Christians do not adopt such crude and direct approaches to converting our people. They tend to be much more sophisticated, and they use approaches much more indirect and nuanced. Joe Dean, who founded a group in the United States called Christians for Israel, once wrote in a very, very forthcoming statement to the National Courier, "By standing with the Jewish people in love and support, we can provoke them to jealousy, as the Apostle Paul said, so as to win them to Christ, not by cramming the gospel down their throats, but by showing that our faith produces fruitful works. I have told the Jewish agencies that we are not a missionary group as such, and this is true. We are not actively trying to win Jews over to Christ, but by taking this approach, the Jewish people don't run away from us, and we're able to witness to them indirectly." Frank Eichler, who ran an organization for many years that's still active called Shalom International, wrote the following in a letter to his Christian supporters. You won't hear this in his pronouncements to the Jewish community. "It's a name that caused Jews to blink and shrink back in fear. It's a name that was used most frequently by those punching Jewish faces, destroying Jewish property, and even killing Jewish people. The name was not Adolf Hitler. It was Jesus Christ. However, those hating in his name never knew him. They weren't real Christians. But Jews did not know that. They just knew that Jesus and pain went together. But not anymore. Because every time that we absorb some of the hate aimed at the Jewish people, every time that we rush to their side when they are lied about, every time that we are the first Gentiles to identify with their fears and their pain and their loneliness, they will see another Jesus, the real one. I want to see Christians all across America wake up and stand up for the Jewish people. Only then will Jews be impressed and one day want Jesus as their Messiah. There are almost 6 million Jews living in North America today. What a harvest field we have right under our noses. The key to Jewish hearts is unconditional love." And therefore, we've had over the years many, many, many projects, like Project Kibbutz, that organized volunteers to go to Israel during the 1980s, during the war in Lebanon, when so many Jewish soldiers had to go off their kibbutzim, they couldn't work the land. And so these wonderful volunteers came to Israel to work on the kibbutzim, to relieve the shortage of manpower. And they were told two things: work very hard and keep your mouth shut. Don't talk about Jesus. And smile a lot, which they did. And Israelis are on the kibbutzim, and they're saying, "We can't understand you people. You don't even live here. You're just coming in and volunteering, and you work so hard, and you always seem so happy. What's going on?" And then these people were encouraged to share their personal relationship with Jesus. And ultimately, Project Kibbutz was exposed for what it really was. It was a project to convert Israelis under the guise, initially, of a works help project. Unfortunately, there is often tremendous myopia in the Jewish community when it comes to the hidden agenda of some Christian evangelical groups. I have a lengthy correspondence that was provided to me by a journalist in the United States He was corresponding with the head of a major Jewish defense organization that was working very closely with an organization in New Jersey called the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministries, although they changed their name recently to the Friends of Israel. This organization insisted that this group had no hidden agenda. They were not interested in converting Jews. And the director of the organization said many times in his correspondence, they never tried to convert me in any of the time I spent with them. And how often I've heard this line from Jewish people who say to me, they're not interested in converting me because I've never had them try to convert me. Now let's try to analyze these words. Let's use as an analogy Kiruv work in the Jewish community. How are people often attracted to traditional Judaism? Do you think it's always done by people, for example, that go out in a truck and call people over and say, are you Jewish? Can I wrap tefillin on you? Kiruv work is not always as overt as that. Jewish outreach work is often quite subtle and uses simply developing relationships with people, having people over for Shabbat. You never have to ask your Shabbat guests, well, do you want to take upon yourself the observance of Shabbat? There never has to be a request to sign on the dotted line. But when people offer to share what they have with others, that is outreach. That is evangelism, even if there's no overt request that the people you're speaking to convert. Sometimes, on the other hand, I must confess, there are Jewish groups that exhibit a rabid antagonism to any Christian group that borders on paranoia. They will see any offer of help in Israel as tainted, any offer of assistance as duplicitous, any offer of assistance as a concealed attempt to convert Jews. And I think that what we need to understand is that we can't judge all Christians as being exactly the same. There are some Christian groups that do use their support for Israel as a cloaked way of making inroads into the Jewish community for conversion purposes, but that doesn't speak about all Christian groups, and that's an important distinction. I want to conclude by just sharing the idea that this topic is one where there's tremendous complexity due to the tremendous diversity of the people we're speaking about. The same way you can't speak about all Jews or even all Orthodox Jews in one fell swoop. We can't speak about all Christians or all evangelicals as if they are all exactly the same. And therefore, because of the complexity of this issue, it precludes any kind of simplistic cookie-cutter approach. The consensus of most Jewish leaders seems to be that any port in a storm will do. And I believe that we need to take a stance that really sounds more like Chabdehu v'Chashdehu. We need to give these people tremendous honor. We need to respect them. Yet we need to be a bit cautious and keep our eyes open. The reality is that virtually all Christian support for Israel is unilateral, which means that they will continue to pray for Israel, to support Israel, to lobby on behalf of Israel, to donate to Israel. They will continue to do everything they've been doing with us or without us. They're not asking for our approval. They're not asking for our cooperation. The only question really becomes one of Hakaras HaTov. How much thanks do we express? I believe we need to maintain two critical cautions. Number one, I believe that it's crucial that we do not unnecessarily expose Amcha, the Jewish public, to the Christian world. To share with you one brief example that happened here in Toronto. A number of years ago, there was a Christian organization that wanted to organize a joint prayer rally to bring 15,000 people to the Air Canada Center. 7,000 born-again Christians and 7,000 Jews. And many people thought it was a great idea. And there were many of us that thought this was a horrible idea. If 7,000 Christians want to pray in their churches for Israel, that's great. But to bring 7,000 Jews from across the entire Jewish community to spend an evening of prayer with evangelical Christians is just asking for trouble. When you have so many Jewish people, unfortunately, living in a Jewish world where you see virtually no passion in our synagogues, you have to look very far to find someone crying in shul these days. And to bring people that have only been exposed to a very lukewarm kind of Jewish experience to a room full or a stadium full of Christians who are rolling on the floor and crying and have more passion than we can imagine is only asking to help the Christian world to do what they want to do, which is the book of Romans says in chapter 15, to provoke the Jews to jealousy. For years and years and years, Christians for Israel magazine here in Toronto, every single one of their issues said that by loving Israel and supporting Israel, we're going to provoke the Jewish people to jealousy. That may not sound that familiar to you, but in context in the Christian Bible, it means that this provoking us to jealousy is spiritual jealousy. And they see that the Jewish people will desire what they have spiritually. And one other concern is that we shouldn't unwittingly cooperate with Christian groups that use their support of Israel directly and expressly as a way of lubricating the conversion process. Again, if we read what they say, not to our community, if we read carefully what they write to their own communities, what some of these groups express to their own Christian supporters, they give away themselves very easily. They explain exactly what they're doing and for what reasons. And I believe it would be a terrible mistake for the Jewish community to unnecessarily cooperate and work with groups that are very expressly supporting Israel for the purpose of converting Jews. I think that it's very difficult to calibrate the cost-effectiveness of our relationship with the evangelical world. And I hope that this overview this afternoon has shed more light than heat on this very sensitive issue. If there's time, Rabbi Kelman, for questions?
Yeah, 20 minutes or so for questions. So
okay.
Thank you, Rabbi Skobach. My question is, because I'm a doctor and I see it in my practice that many Christians are much more passionate about their religion, many Muslims are much more passionate about their religion than we Jews. How do we, as Jews, become more passionate about our own religion?
You know, the Kutzker Rebbe said, Zeir dinin sheker mit emes and mir dinin emes mit sheker. He said that they often serve their sheker with truth, and we unfortunately so often serve our truth with falseness. I think it's a serious indictment of our Jewish world. And, you know, I was blessed to grow up in a home where I saw my grandmother, when she lit Shabbos candles, she was crying. She had tears coming down her eyes. And there was a time in the Jewish world where we were much more free with our expression. We were less inhibited. And I'm not exactly sure what the cause of this has become. Maybe it's living in the cold climate of North America. But I'm not sure that really explains the situation. Your question is really a good one, an important one. And there are some very, very thoughtful people who have been thinking about this question over the past few decades. And I'll just share with you maybe one or two thoughts, because it's a topic unto itself. It's an old problem, and going back already to the times of the Bible, right? Our prophets told us that sometimes we get into a rut, and we practice Judaism on automatic pilot, and it's not a modern problem, therefore. And the question is how to break out of this. So in Jewish history, there have been institutionalized responses to this kind of problem, this kind of stagnation, if you will. For example, one of them was the Hasidic revolution. One of them was the Musar movement. So I would say that these are technologies that in the past were developed and are undergoing a bit of a renaissance in the Jewish world today. And I think that one way of approaching your question is for us to basically, first of all, recognize that there is a problem. That, you know, that when we don't recognize what you're describing, nothing is going to happen. But if we sometimes stop ourselves and ask ourselves when we're in shul one weekend, or even when we're just on our own, in our own Jewish world, to say, like, what's going on with me? What's my spiritual temperature? Am I hot? Am I lukewarm? Am I getting a bit cold? So to recognize that we sometimes as a community are not as hot as we could be and we should be. And once there's a recognition that this is a problem, then to seek and to access the kind of technologies that have been developed over the course of Jewish history to break out of this rut. And I would say that that might be a first step for many of us, is to just be conscious and aware that we've gotten into a bit of a rut sometimes. We have cooled down. You know, they say that the worst thing that Amalek did to the Jews when we came out of Egypt, it says, Asher karcha baderech, right? They cooled us down. That when we came out of Egypt, we were on fire for God, but Amalek cooled us down. So to recognize that sometimes our spiritual passion has cooled down, and then to search. There are plenty of people, there are plenty of mentors and gurus and teachers and inspirational people that's their life work to help bring us up a little bit, to help raise our level, to light our neshamas. And I think that if we have the recognition that we need help and we seek the help, we'll find what we need, each of us, as individuals and communities, to really bring us out of the rut, I think, that we are in. So thank you for your question. We're going to have the MC is going to modify.
We've had some. Can you hear me? Is this working? Yeah.
Yes.
We've had some experience with the evangelical Christians. We've traveled with them to Israel. And I have to say I've learned a lot. First of all, they can teach us how to pray and how to talk to God and how to feel and how to express ourselves. We are bound to the words of the Siddur. We don't know how to pray. You go in, you got to dub them very fast because you got to say it all. We learned from the Christians. You know what I learned from them? I learned how to daven from them. I learned how to feel and how to cry, and they can teach us so much. I remember also when I don't know who it was. Somebody was very sick in the hospital. It was a member of my family, I guess. And I watched the Christian pastors come in to the hospital. And I watched a woman pastor with a patient. And she put her hand on the patient. And she spoke to God, "Dear God, here is so-and-so. They're in trouble. They are sick. They need your help. Please, God." This is the way they pray. They just don't come in and say, "Misha Berach." They can teach us how to pray and how to be religious. And like you say, the Hasidic movement and so on, where there's emotion, where there's feeling and so on, we have been locked out of it. And most of us don't know enough, and we don't know how to do it. So there's a lot to be learned from them. They're very beautiful people, and they know. And they're very pious people, and they're very sincere. And there is much just that experience alone has been very, very worthwhile. They talk to God directly. They're not tied to text. Not that they don't know Bible. They do. They know the Bible by heart and beautifully. But they talk to God. And I think we can learn from them a great deal. They're wonderful people in that sense.
I think that what you're saying is true, but I think that it illustrates very, very poignantly what I feel is one of the great dangers of exposing Jewish amcha to this world. I don't know if we need to learn from evangelical Christians the art of speaking to God. Right? This is something that we've already been doing since the times of the Bible. Tevye did it. Rav Nachman of Breslov did it. But unfortunately, what you're describing is very true, that for many, many Jewish people, prayer is unfortunately artificially limited to the liturgy. They don't even understand that Jews can speak to God in their own language. And therefore, what you're describing is a perfect scenario where some Jews will not take that experience and want to bring it back to Judaism. They're going to go with the jealousy. They're going to say, wow, I want to have exactly what they have. Because they assume it doesn't exist in the Jewish world. They assume that it's not a Jewish option. And therefore, this is precisely the kind of experience that when Jewish people spend quality time with Christians. Now, I want to make something very clear. It's not their fault. I think that for us to feel that we can sort of ghettoize ourselves and block ourselves off from the whole world because we have spiritual weaknesses and we're not what we could be spiritually is a mistake. I believe that the onus is not on the Christian world to protect us. I believe that it's our job, as the previous questioner asked, how do we as a Jewish community create a Jewish community, Jewish homes, Jewish synagogues, Jewish schools that radiate this kind of joy and passion and developing a personal relationship with God and not just going through the motions, which is often what happens. I believe that if we did have that kind of a Jewish world, I'd feel much less concern of interacting with Christians, much less concern. But I'm very realistic about what the state of our health is as a community. We're a community which is not healthy across the board. And therefore, I find personally that for Jews, in most cases, to spend that kind of quality time with Christians, praying with them, traveling with them, is really exposing them to something which is very, very dangerous to their souls. Thank God you had a different reaction. But I'm not sure that your reaction is across the board in a Jewish sense. I could tell you that my experience has been that most Jewish people convert to Christianity precisely because they met a Christian friend or neighbor or business associate that inspired them. And the Jewish person said, I want what that Christian has. I want their passion. I want their ability to speak to God on a personal level. And therefore, this is a very, very difficult area. It's an area that we have to be very cautious about.
If I may, I'm going to take the
Rabbi Jay.
I'm going to make you address a very difficult issue as a result of this. And Dr. Korn alluded to it earlier. The fact that interdenominationally the split in our community and the fear of many people in the Orthodox world to talk to Reform and Conservative Jews. Do you see sort of a parallel here that they're afraid? I see that a lot, that they're afraid if they expose their own people to Reform, etc., they'll be, you know, attracted to it. Or the same way you're feeling that if the Jews are exposed to the passion of the evangelical, you know, community, they'll be attracted to it. I think the issue is
But Rabbi Kelman, I'm saying it with a broken heart.
No, I realize that.
Because I'll tell you the truth, I feel that Jews should be able to travel with Christians. You know, when I go on an airplane, I always tell this to my classes, I always say two prayers. I pray to God for a safe flight, and I say, God, if you're going to put me next to a talker, let it be a born-again Christian. Because I just have a great time with these people. But as a person who's a teacher in the Jewish community, I have a sense that across the board, when we look at the Jewish community, the widest spectrum, we're not well-versed in our Bible. We're not comfortable speaking to God personally. And I think we are easily impressed by the passion and spirituality of Christians.
So I'm asking you to apply that to the Orthodox and Reform model, to take what you're saying to the if you want to, or if you want to leave that question aside, it's too
I have to be honest. I really don't know, because I suspect that there are other reasons why we have these internal fissures in the Jewish community, and I don't know if it really is a fear factor that prevents traditional Jews from interacting with those of other denominations. I suspect that it's often a fear of granting legitimacy and not a fear of being affected personally. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I mean, okay. There's more on that.
There was a time, a Rabbi, when the boobies and the mummies and the einiklach all lived close to one another and they had Shabbosim and Yom Tovim together. It was real Simchadik, it was real Yiddish, it was beautiful. Today, the boobies don't have anything to do with the mummies, and the children who go to universities are targeted by the Jew haters, who hate not only the Jews, but hate Israel too. And the young ones run away from all of it. They don't want to know anything about Judaism. I think it's time that we went back to the old way, when Bubi and Mami and Einikel all enjoyed Shabbosim and Yom Tovim together.
Chadei Shemenu Kekedem. Okay.
Okay. One last question, and then we'll. I don't hear.
Fair enough, equity.
If we lack our own fire, or at least we're or at least maybe left it in a closet somewhere, we need to fish it out of the attic. How can we inspire those who are at risk in the community? What can we do? You know, recognizing that we need to improve our own spiritual connection. How can we then turn and inspire people who are further down at risk in the community?
So you really answered your own question. That the Hasidim used to say, if you want to fill a saucer with tea, overflow the cup. So you can't really inspire people unless you yourself are inspired. We all know that the best salesperson is the one that really believes in their product. I remember a few years ago when one of the Messianic Jewish congregations opened here in Toronto. They started off at the Barbara Frum Library. I always have a funny name for a Jews for Jesus congregation, Barbara Frum Library. But we took six rabbis with us from the Bathurst and Lawrence area to go to their Friday night service. And I'll never forget the reaction of the rabbis. It was very strong. They were shocked, and they expressed this shock and said, these people really believe this stuff. They really believe it. And the truth is that that's their strength. They really believe what they're doing. They have tremendous, tremendous faith. And I think that if we want to think about being able to inspire others, we need to first inspire ourselves. We always hear, when we go on an airplane, the cabin crew says that if there's a problem with the cabin pressure and the air masks come down, put it on yourself first, and then you put it on your children, right? That we can't hope to inspire others unless we ourselves are inspired. And again, that happens through working on our davening and working on our learning Torah and working on our performance of mitzvot and really looking for people that are inspiring. There are, thank God, in the world today, inspired Jews who are on fire for God. They have a tremendous passion for spirituality, and we can access these people. We are able to find them and learn from them. You know, we learn in Pirkei Avos, Asei Lecha Rav. That's an important thing. Find a role model, find a teacher, find a guide that we can learn how to deepen our relationship with Hashem and with Torah and Yiddishkeit. You know, one of the great tragedies is that our curriculum over the years has gotten truncated. That we go through schools, even in the best of Jewish schools sometimes, without exposing our students to some of the more inspirational parts of Jewish literature and Jewish tradition. I don't know if we can limit our curriculum, for example, just to learning Tanakh and Shulchan Aruch and Mishnah and Talmud. I think that there's something that needs to be, we need to expose Jewish children and young and Jewish adults to some of the to parts of Judaism that really are directly made to be inspirational. Some of the literature of the Musar masters, people like Rav Tzadok HaKohen and the Sfas Emes and the Maharal. We have a literature that was designed to be directly inspirational and to take people to the depths of Yiddishkeit. I want to just end with one comment on this idea. If you spend time at a university and you find almost any Christian student, almost any Christian student, and ask them about their relationship with God, they will feel a tremendous ease at speaking to you about their spiritual life and what goes on in their inner life and their relationship with God. They can go on for probably an hour or two, easily. And I think that if you were to go to any university today and just grab a student wearing a kippah and ask the first student you grab, tell me about your spiritual life, your relationship with God, I think you'll find people that are much less able to speak about their own spiritual experiences, their personal relationship with God, their inner life. I think that we're just uncomfortable at it because we haven't given our students the language to use. So I believe that this has to be incorporated into the curriculum of our schools and into our lives as we get older, maybe when we graduate yeshivot, to really learn to access the literature, the technology, the teachers, the guides that have existed throughout Jewish history to really raise us up to these higher spiritual levels. To learn not just the laws of prayer, but learn about inspirational works about prayer. What is prayer all about? What does it mean? We often learn the techniques, but not the heart, not the feeling. So I believe that this is really crucial if we want to think about inspiring others to really develop this in ourselves first. Rabbi Kelman, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much.